Today is Monday, October 11th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Ruoko, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Taliban beefs up security amid growing Islamic State attacks.
The Islamic State started its operations in Afghanistan in 2015, but never in the last 5 or 6 years we have seen this kind of a large number of attacks.
Plus, Taiwan vows to bolster defenses against China.
China has long claimed Taiwan as its own territory, with the island facing growing military and political pressure to accept Beijing's rule.
Also, UN funding shortage cuts aid to over 10 million in the DRC. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. The United States said on Sunday the first face-to-face meeting of senior U.S. and Taliban officials since the hardline group retook power in Afghanistan was, quote, candid and professional, unquote. State Department spokesman Ned Price said the U.S. delegation at the weekend talks in Doha, Qatar, focused on security and terrorism concerns and safe passage for U.S. citizens, other foreign nationals, and Afghans. They also discussed human rights, including for women. Price said the two sides discussed the U.S. providing, quote, robust humanitarian assistance, unquote, to the Afghan people, but he did not say if the U.S. had agreed to do so. The Taliban, however, said the U.S. had agreed to provide aid to the country, which is on the brink of an economic disaster. The Taliban said the talks, quote, went well, unquote. The United States made it clear that the talks were not a preamble to recognition of the Taliban, who swept into power August 15th after the U.S. allied government collapsed. Taliban political spokesman Sohail Shaheen also told the Associated Press that the movement's interim foreign minister assured the U.S. during the talks that the Taliban are committed to seeing that Afghan soil is not used by extremists to launch attacks against any other countries. The Taliban has beefed up security in Kabul and other districts following a spate of attacks and bomb blasts linked to the Islamic State terror group and its affiliates. The Taliban has, however, ruled out security cooperation with Western nations despite over 40 attacks since NATO and the U.S. troops pulled out of Afghanistan in August. Taliban spokesman Sohail Shaheen says its forces has the capacity to rein in attacks from extremist groups. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gar.
Well, obviously, this is quite a serious security challenge now facing the Taliban in Afghanistan. This is a situation where Taliban have not been able to really present their case, whether they will be able to suppress it, this threat, because the Islamic State started its operations in Afghanistan in 2015, but never in the last 5 or 6 years we have seen this kind of a large number of attacks by this group in Afghanistan. So they have said that they have launched a security operation in different parts of the country where they suspect IS, Islamic State, Khorasan province have their strong bases, and that they have killed a number of their members and they have arrested like more than 14 of them. But these appear to be simply claims because there has been no stopping of these attacks.
Despite the deteriorating security, the Taliban is saying it's not going to cooperate with either United States or any outside government to try to rein in this IS. Is this because of their confidence in securing the country, or they're just afraid people might see them as weak if they accept foreign help?
Obviously, the United States has been warning that the Islamic State poses a serious challenge now in Afghanistan, now that all American forces have left. But today, even the chief Taliban spokesman, Zabiullah Mujahid, in a statement to local media, once again claimed that they are able to suppress this threat, that they will be able to overcome this challenge. And in that statement, Zabiullah Mujahid was asked that whether they would cooperate with the United States in dealing with this threat. He once again categorically rejected any such cooperation with the United States, saying that they don't see, according to him, Islamic State as a serious threat, but just, according to Zabiullah Mujahid, a headache, and that they will be able to deal with it on their own and they don't need it. And obviously, because the Taliban have been fighting on their own this war in Afghanistan when the United States and allied forces were present in Afghanistan. So now if they go back into a security cooperation with the United States on this issue, obviously they will face definitely some kind of backlash from within its ranks, because Taliban fighters, as they think that they have been able to defeat the world's only superpower and that they are capable of dealing with these challenges.
What has been Pakistan's reaction to the growing bombings by IS and other security issues in Afghanistan?
Pakistan is certainly worried. One of the tribal areas which border Afghanistan, which is called South Waziristan, there was an attack in that district of Pakistan where a Shiite resident of the area was massacred, and Islamic State on its official website claimed responsibility for this attack. So it seems that not only that Islamic State regional branch has extended its extremist operations to 5 provinces of Afghanistan, but on this side of the border, their activity is picking up. So obviously, Pakistan is worried, but we see there's a lot of enhancement of the border security, which is quite a long border, and Pakistan has fenced this border. But inside Pakistan, there are religious groups, there are banned organizations, which have, according to officials, sleeping cells, which might have joined hands with Islamic State, and they could cause problems. So that's why Pakistan is urging the United States and other international partners to really do something quickly to help the Taliban in Afghanistan to bring the situation to normalcy as quickly as possible, so there's no chaos in the country, because that's what is going to spill over.
That's viewers Ayaz Gaur speaking with me from Islamabad. Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen has said the island will keep bolstering its defenses to ensure nobody can force it to accept unification with mainland China under undemocratic terms. Jason Albano of Reuters reports.
Fighter jets paraded across Taiwan's skies on Sunday, marking the island's National Day. Addressing a rally outside the presidential office in Taipei, leader Tsai Ing-wen continued to rebuff comments made by Chinese President Xi Jinping, who said he wanted to see a peaceful reunification with Taiwan.
We will continue to bolster our national defense and demonstrate our determination to defend ourselves in order to ensure that nobody can force Taiwan to take the path China has laid out for us. A path that offers neither a free and democratic way of life for Taiwan.
China has long claimed Taiwan as its own territory, with the island facing growing military and political pressure to accept Beijing's rule. That includes repeated Chinese Air Force missions in Taiwan's airspace, which Tsai says has seriously affected national security and aviation safety. China's activities there have been condemned internationally. Tsai's speech comes a day after Xi vowed to realize China's reunification with Taiwan. Although he didn't directly mention the use of force, his comments drew an angry backlash from Taipei. Tsai said only Taiwan's people can decide the future.
We will not act rashly, but there should be absolutely no illusions that the Taiwanese people will bow to pressure.
Though Taiwan has repeatedly called for talks with Beijing, it refuses to deal with her and instead has branded her a separatist. She warned her people on Sunday, quote, "We do not have the privilege of letting down our guard."
That was Jason Albano reporting for Reuters. As the U.S. national rate of COVID-19 infections declines, vaccine mandates for some jobs are pushing some employees to get shots while others protest. Michelle Quinn reports.
It's a moment that's long been coming in the United States, with 76% of people in the country having had at least one vaccination. Deadlines are approaching fast in workplaces, requiring employees to get the shot against COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, or risk losing their jobs. That has resulted in some pushback from employees. In Los Angeles, the sheriff said he will not enforce the county's vaccine mandate when it comes to his 18,000 employees. Alex Villanueva spoke on Facebook Live.
There are entire groups of employees that are willing to be fired and laid off rather than get vaccinated. So I don't want to be in a position to lose 5-10% of my workforce overnight on a vaccine mandate.
These tensions come as the U.S. daily rate of COVID-19 infections has declined to about 95,000 new cases. That's a drop from a high during the most recent peak in September of 172,000 a day, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the global outbreak. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, told CNN's State of the Union program he is optimistic about the pandemic's trajectory, but it's too soon to roll back pandemic restrictions such as masking.
I'd like to see it well below 10,000 and even much lower than that. But when you're at 95,000, that's still a situation where you have a high degree of dynamic circulation of virus in the community.
Health officials are expected to meet later this month to discuss Pfizer's application for emergency approval for children aged 5 to 11 to get its vaccine. Pfizer has proposed giving children one-third of the adult dosage. Former Food and Drug Administration head Scott Gottlieb, who sits on Pfizer's board, told CBS's Face the Nation that vaccine mandates for school children will likely be years off.
12 to 17 could be a couple of years away, perhaps a little longer. I think 5 to 11 is even longer than that. You're going to want to get more experience in those children.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration has pledged $1 billion to purchase millions of at-home rapid COVID-19 tests amid reports of test kit shortages around the country. By December, the White House says it will have a supply of 200 million kits per month. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
The marathon COVID lockdown in Australia's biggest city, Sydney, ended Monday for vaccinated residents. Stay-at-home orders imposed on June 26th have been lifted. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
What will you do first? Dance?
Government advertisements have urged Australians to be vaccinated against COVID-19, promising that freedoms would be returned when vaccination rates passed certain milestones. The message has been getting through to the community. A 106-day lockdown in the New South Wales state capital, Sydney, was lifted Monday because inoculation rates have passed 70% for people aged 16 and older. Gyms, restaurants and hairdressers have reopened for the first time since late June. Small gatherings at home are now permitted, and larger groups are allowed to meet at parks and beaches. However, the freedoms apply only to those who've been fully vaccinated. However, all residents still face restrictions on travel beyond Sydney. Those rules will be eased when vaccination rates in New South Wales reach 80%. At that point, international travel, which has been heavily restricted since March 2020, will resume. But authorities expect coronavirus infections to increase as restrictions are lifted. New South Wales State Premier Dominic Perrottet says a cautious, staged approach to reopening is needed.
There's going to be challenges as we move through this period. I think we're the first state in the nation that's going down a path where those coming out to visit pubs and restaurants and cafes need to be double vaccinated. That will have its challenges along the way, but I think if everyone treats each other with respect and kindness during this period, we're going to open up safely.
Vaccinations are mandatory in Australia for health workers, some teachers and other occupations. The country's drug regulator has said the vaccines are safe and effective, yet research shows that about 10% of Australians are hesitant about receiving a COVID-19 shot. Sydney resident Jamal Daoud says he doesn't trust the safety of vaccines.
I don't believe the pandemic is deadly to the point of enforcing people to take a vaccine that was not proven to be safe. We don't have enough data that this vaccine is safe.
In New South Wales, all restrictions on unvaccinated residents will be lifted when immunisation rates reach 90%. Millions of people, however, remain in lockdown in the Australian cities of Melbourne and Canberra. Australia has diagnosed 127,500 coronavirus infections since the start of the pandemic. More than 1,400 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A UN official says a funding shortage means humanitarian aid will have to be cut for many of the nearly 10 million people in the DRC, which faces multiple crises because of lack of money, a senior United Nations official says. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A UN official says a funding shortfall means it will be difficult for the United Nations to provide needed aid to Democratic Republic of the Congo. Conflict in eastern DRC has forced 5.3 million people to flee their homes, Africa's largest number of internally displaced people. Additionally, conflict in neighboring countries has prompted more than 500,000 refugees to flee to DRC. The UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in DRC, David McLachlan Carr, says millions of people in the eastern provinces are victims of long simmering inter-ethnic conflicts and conflicts over natural resources. He says the situation is particularly concerning in Ituri, North Kivu, and South Kivu provinces, as well as territories in northern Tanganyika. These protracted conflicts, he says, have left millions of people destitute and in urgent need of assistance. He says it will be difficult to provide that aid because only 27% of the UN's nearly $2 billion appeal for this year has been funded.
Impacting our ability to reach the most vulnerable. And those populations, of course, leave us with a very stark choice. Who do we assist when we have such reduced amounts of assistance? Forcing us to prioritize in the DRC, which is a vast country with multiple crises.
For example, he says the country is prone to repeated epidemics of many diseases, including Ebola, cholera, measles, and malaria. Currently, he says, the DRC is facing a lethal meningitis outbreak. McLachlan Carr says a recent World Food Program and UNICEF survey found 26.7 million people suffering from acute hunger.
And they're literally living day to day in a precarious situation with an inadequate nutritional intake leading to essentially a weakened condition, which of course makes them more prone and vulnerable to disease across the country.
McLachlan Carr says priority needs include food, shelter, health care, water and sanitation, education, as well as psychosocial counseling for victims of gender and sexual abuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Talks between India and Chinese army commanders to disengage troops from key friction areas along their border have ended in a stalemate and failed to ease a 17-month standoff. The failure on Sunday's talks means the two nations will keep troops in the forward areas of Ladakh for a second consecutive winter in dangerously freezing temperatures. India's defense ministry said it gives, quote, constructive suggestions, unquote, but the Chinese side was, quote, not agreeable, unquote. While the Chinese military said India stopped to, quote, unreasonable and unrealistic demands, unquote. Mozambique's police general commander on Monday confirmed the death of dissident guerrilla leader and former member of RENAMO, Mariano Nhongo, in combat operations. At a press conference, Bernardino Rafael said that Nhongo was killed around 7 a.m. today after intense fighting in the forest of Safala province, where he was hiding. On 4th October, the President of the Republic, Filipe Nyusi, revealed that the Defense and Security Forces had reached the base of his group, but Nhongo escaped. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The World Health Organization has published a new mental health atlas marking World Mental Health Day with call on governments to allocate the money needed to increase access to mental health treatment. We have Lisa Schlein again reporting from Geneva.
Data collected from 171 countries show none of the World Health Assembly targets for the provision of mental health care by 2020 has been achieved. Therefore, WHO says it is extending its comprehensive mental health action plan to 2030. Fami Hanna is a technical officer in WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Use. He says lack of money is a major reason these goals have been missed. He says governments allocate just 2.1% of their overall health budgets to mental health services.
And in majority of the countries, most of this budget goes to psychiatric hospitals, long-stay inpatient facilities, instead of being spent on community-based mental health services, which are more human rights-oriented and less decentralized and more accessible to the population.
The WHO reports more than a billion people globally suffer from mental health illness. The most common such illnesses include anxiety disorders, depression, bipolar and eating disorders, as well as psychotic disorders, including schizophrenia. The data in the atlas was collected in 2019 and reflects the status of pre-pandemic mental health services. However, health officials agree COVID-19 is having a major impact on people's mental health, and more investments must be made in treating them. Hannah says WHO has carried out two surveys during the pandemic. He says the findings show major disruptions in services offered to people suffering from neurological illnesses and substance abuse.
At a time where there was calls for scaling up mental health services around the world, we found from data of the rapid survey that was conducted in 2021 that actually 23% of countries have reported scaling back their community-based mental health services.
Besides the human costs, WHO says skimping on investing in mental health makes no economic sense. It says lost productivity from depression and anxiety alone, two of the most common mental health disorders, cost the global economy $1 trillion each year. However, it notes there is a return of $5 for every dollar invested in treating these conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A car bomb targeting the governor's convoy shook Yemen's southern port city of Aden on Sunday, killing several people, security and military sources said. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
A car bomb targeting the governor's convoy shook the Yemeni city of Aden on Sunday. Several people were killed and injured in the attack, according to security and military sources. Governor Ahmed Lamlas and Agriculture Minister Salem Al-Sukatri survived what the state news agency called a terrorist assassination attempt. Both are members of a southern separatist group known as the Southern Transitional Council. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but an STC spokesman blamed Islamist militant groups in a statement. Lamlas is Secretary General of the STC, which has vied with the Saudi-backed government for control of Aden and Yemen's wider south. The government and the STC are nominal allies under a coalition led by Saudi Arabia, which have together been battling the Iran-aligned Houthi movement. Riyadh had brokered a deal to end the power struggle, including forming a new cabinet that includes STC members. But tensions have simmered regardless. The STC has also seen infighting among its ranks. Instability in the south complicates United Nations-led peace efforts to end the war in Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of people and left 80% of the population reliant on aid. The government is based in the south of the country, while the Houthis control most of the north.
That was Lauren Anthony with Reuters. In the Rimon crater in the desert of southern Israel, a team of six, five men and one woman, have begun simulating what it would be like to live for about a month on Mars. This report produced by Chris Dingham of Reuters.
In the desert of southern Israel, a team of six scientists have begun simulating what it might be like to live on Mars. The red-hued Rimon crater will be home for about a month to the five men and one woman participating in the mission. Their Amadi 20 habitat is tucked beneath a rocky step. Inside, they sleep, eat, and conduct experiments. Outside, they wear mock spacesuits fitted with cameras, microphones, and self-contained breathing systems. Dr. Gernot Gromer, the director of the Austrian Space Forum running the project, says the more mistakes they make during the simulation, the better.
We have the motto of fail fast, fail cheap, and have a steep learning curve, because for every mistake we make here on Earth, we hopefully don't repeat it on Mars, because we've done it before.
The Austrian Association is collaborating with the Israel Space Agency and local group D-Mars. The six team members are constantly on camera with their vital signs monitored, and their movements inside the habitat are tracked to analyze favorite spots for congregating. 36-year-old Alon Tenzer is on the simulation team.
Yeah, we're six people working in tight space under a lot of pressure to do a lot of tasks. There are bound to be challenges, but I trust my crew that we're able to overcome those challenges. We learn how to work together, we train together, and we're very confident.
Outside, other engineers and specialists will work with a drone and rover to improve autonomous navigation and mapping on a world where GPS is not available. Altogether, they will carry out more than 20 experiments in fields including geology, biology, and medicine, and hope to publish some of the results when finished.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu.